your community radio station, keeping you connected. Radio Catskill.
From WJFF in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable, our monthly check-in with our region's journalists and the topics that are making headlines. We'll get an update on the Ulster County Executive, White Lake drownings, a New York State trooper kills an Ulster man in Warwissing, plus an update on broadband in Sullivan County, the Sullivan County gun law, and the Sullivan County Airport. Cancer Survivor Days. The Northeast Regional Cancer Institute's 30th Annual Cancer Survivors Day, honoring and remembering and sharing. We'll speak to the executive director. And listening to the bees, we speak to the artist behind an immersive sound installation that weaves together recordings of bees and will be installed at the upcoming Narrowsburg Honeybee Fest. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. President Biden is leaving this hour for London. He and First Lady Jill Biden are scheduled to fly to the UK in about a half an hour for the Queen Elizabeth State funeral on Monday. The two will be in the air as thousands have descended on London to view the Queen's coffin at Westminster Hall, undeterred by warnings of wait times of at least 14 hours. Vicky Barker reports from London.
Stories of community and new friendships are coming out of the slow-moving queue, which snakes past major London landmarks for up to 5 miles along the River Thames. Hundreds of volunteers are trying to keep those waiting as safe and as comfortable as possible. Matt Hyde, head of the Scout Association, telling the BBC.
I think it just shows the incredible power of civil society, and that in a way is inspired by the service and selflessness of the Queen herself.
Patient queuing has always been seen as a particularly British trait. Several observers have noted that at one point there was even a queue for the queue to join the queue. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
King Charles and his son Prince William unexpectedly turned up today to visit with people waiting in line. The Justice Department is asking an appeals court to lift a federal judge's order that temporarily bars investigators from reviewing classified documents seized from Mar-a-Lago. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports on this latest move in the legal battle stemming from the court-authorized search of former President Trump's Florida home.
The Justice Department is asking the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta for what it calls modest but critically important relief. It wants the appeals court to allow the FBI to use classified materials seized at Mar-a-Lago in its ongoing criminal investigation and to prevent a special master from reviewing the classified records. In its filing to the appeals court, the Justice Department says a ruling from a lower court that temporarily bars investigators from using the seized classified materials in the criminal probe, quote, impedes the government's efforts to protect national security. The Justice Department is asking the appeals court to act as soon as possible. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Massachusetts Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito says the migrants who arrived on Martha's Vineyard from San Antonio early Wednesday are getting the services they need.
We're well equipped to support and to provide the services needed to help these individuals.
The migrants have been taken to a military base on Cape Cod, where state officials say they will be provided with shelter, food, and other essential services. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is being accused of playing a political game. His office arranged the flights, the latest move by Republicans to send migrants to Democratic strongholds. And from Washington, you're listening to NPR News. The British Defense Ministry's latest intelligence update says Russian forces in northeast Ukraine are setting up a new defensive line in the region about 90 miles southeast of Kharkiv, where Ukrainian forces are pressing their counteroffensive. Also, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling the discovery of hundreds of bodies buried in territory that's been recaptured proof of war crimes by Russian forces. Forecasters are warning western Alaska of hurricane-force winds and severe coastal flooding this weekend. The National Weather Service says the storm is likely to be the strongest to hit Alaska in more than a decade. From member station KYUK, Nina Kravinsky reports.
Coastal communities could see water levels 5 to 8 feet higher than normal high tide. National Weather Service meteorologist Caitlin O'Brien says the timing of the storm makes it especially unusual.
We have not seen this in the month of September before. So generally, we see our stronger storms in the winter months.
The storm is remnants of Typhoon Merbok that are now moving over the Bering Sea. The National Weather Service has issued flood warnings along much of the western coast of Alaska. Alaska's Emergency Management Division says the storm will hit a part of the state with about 800 miles of coastline. For NPR News, I'm Nina Kravinsky in Bethel, Alaska.
In the Caribbean, Puerto Rico is under a hurricane watch. The island is preparing for potential flooding and power outages from Tropical Storm Fiona. Fiona could be a hurricane when it reaches Puerto Rico later today. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every month, we check in with our region's local journalists for an update on the topics making headlines. Today, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rabayo is joined by Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley of the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the Times Union. It's our monthly Reporters Roundtable.
Hi, my name is Patricio Rabayo, and I'm a producer with WJFF Radio Catskill. Welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Today, I'm joined with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the Times Union. We have a lot to cover, so let's get straight to it. Philip from the Times Union. Philip, let's start with you. The Ulster County Executive was Pat Ryan. Of course, he stepped down from the position to run for the New York 19th Congressional District, which he won. And now he's running for the New York 18th Congressional District because of the redrawn district lines. Philip, who's going to be on the ballot this November for the Ulster County Executive position?
Right. So that's still going to be determined. So last Friday, Joanna Contreras, who had been the Deputy County Executive, she was sworn in as the acting Ulster County Executive. And she will fill out that position through the end of the year. And then there had been some discussion about there maybe being a special election for the county executive in Ulster County. But what they're going to do is put it on the ballot in November. And exactly the name who's going to be on the ballot is to be determined still. So the Republicans, at least as of Wednesday, September 14th, have not put forward a candidate yet. There are three Democrats who have thrown their hats in the ring. Those are former New York State Senator Jen Metzger, another deputy Ulster County Executive Mark Ryder, and the current Ulster County Controller Mark Gallagher. But voters won't get a say on which of those three are on the ballot. So the Ulster County Democratic Committee is going to hold a nominating convention with some version of kind of ranked choice voting among committee members on September 17th, so Saturday, the day that this is airing. It's kind of looking like Jen Metzger is the front runner for that right now, partly because Pat Ryan endorsed her. He said in a statement that she's a person of integrity who brings great compassion to understanding the needs of the community. I found it slightly interesting, I guess, that of the three Democrats who have put their names forward for this position, Pat Ryan endorsed the one who hasn't actually served in his administration. Read into that what you will, maybe. But Jen Metzger, of course, was a state senator until 2020. And, you know, so therefore has won elected office previously and is currently on the Cannabis Control Board and has a lot of executive experience. So that would be the person, I think, who is going to get the nomination. But we'll know more early next week.
On Jen Metzger, do you know if she's elected Ulster County Executive, if she's mentioned already, if that happens, what happens to her position on the Cannabis Control Board?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think she'll probably make that decision if and when she wins. So the election in November is really just to see out the remainder of Pat Ryan's term, which runs through the end of next year, 2023. So, as I mentioned previously, Joanna Contreras is going to be the acting county executive through December 31st of this year. And then whoever wins in November will be sworn in on January 1st of 2023, but they will only be the county executive for a year. And then next November, there will be another election for a full term of county executive.
Here in Sullivan County, we had a tragedy on White Lake in Bethel, New York. A family came from Long Island, I believe, and went to vacation on White Lake in Sullivan County. Unfortunately, tragedy struck the family. Philip, you have spoken about this tragedy already on the local edition previously, but right now you have some updates for us. What can you tell us?
A pretty sad update. So listeners might remember that on August 28th, a brother-in-law of this family, the Amin family from Long Island, went under the water in White Lake. And he died on that day, and so did another family member who went under the water on that day in an attempt to save him. There was a third person who had been on life support for the past 2 weeks, sister of the young man who died on that day. Her name was Nazrin Amin. The family announced that she died on September 10th. She never came off life support. She had been at Bellevue Hospital in New York City after being transferred there shortly after the drowning. She was declared officially brain dead on September 8th, but her heart stopped after they took her off life support early on the morning of September 10th. The family has a GoFundMe page that has gotten a lot of donations to help them pay for funeral and expenses and hospital costs. And in one silver lining to this, perhaps, they're also creating a nonprofit organization, which is called the Amin Foundation, named after the family, that is going to raise funds for water safety education, swimming lessons and training, and equipment for emergency response teams. But yeah, just a really tragic story. This young woman was only 21 years old.
Definitely a tragic situation. My heart goes out to the family. But you said there is a small silver lining in this, that they have created that nonprofit. So maybe another family won't have to suffer the fate of theirs and have those swim lessons and learn water safety and to wear life vests, especially here in this area. Sullivan Catskills, there's been a number of drownings in the waters this year. And is anything we can do to sort of prevent another life to be gone? Keeping on Ulster County news, Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal, we turn to you. There was another tragedy happened in your neck of the woods that involves a state trooper. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's complex. I mean, I don't know whether people have the bare bones of it. I'll do it quickly. But a Friday evening, Ulster County Mobile Mental Health Team had been called, we think, by the victim of this police shooting to his house or his residence, anyway, in Cragsmoor. And he was having some kind of an event. We don't know any details about that yet, but couldn't calm down. The mobile mental health people apparently then called for police backup, and they got probably more than they expected because county sheriffs and state troopers rolled up there at high speed. We had a report from people at the bottom of the ridge who live on the road, seeing a lot of police vehicles roar up the mountain. Anyway, cut to the chase. After efforts to get the young man to drop the large knife that he was waving around, failed. An officer tried to tase him. And as sometimes, well, often seems to happen, the tasing didn't work. It might not have actually reached his skin. Again, a detail we do not know. Shortly after that, again, for reasons we do not know, because they just said that the young man continued to advance towards the police, another trooper shot him dead. Total tragedy. And on the face of it, it seems completely against all modern day police training. at least in advanced areas, where basically you would expect them to back off, set up a perimeter, wait for him to calm down. You know, if there's no one else there, no one's being threatened, then leave him to wave the knife around and just go away. But anyway, he was shot dead. And the reaction in the village of Ellenville amongst people who knew him, because he was a graduate of Ellenville High School in that year 2000, was fairly extreme. A lot of anger has been expressed about this. Investigations of this sort of thing go to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office has been in contact, of course, with his parents. They are due to meet with the Attorney General's office and hear whatever they have to say soon. We have had the names of the troopers involved and published those on our online service. And at this point, that's where this sits. It's a very uncomfortable story. We don't have the details yet to know why the police officer felt it was necessary to shoot Dan McAlpin dead. But he was only, he was 41 years old and had been working the last few years at the public house in Ellenville, which is the bar, grill, you know, small restaurant on the corner of Canal Street and Liberty Square. A tragedy. And as I said, there's a lot of anger in the village that this happened.
A very tragic situation. And the question that comes to mind is, you mentioned that mobile mental health services was there, and just really I want to know what happened as far as why de-escalation didn't happen with mobile health there, and why the state trooper felt the need to shoot the man.
Unfortunately, because of various, laws and, natural, it's all reasonable. You can't talk to mental health. they're not going to respond to reporters' inquiries. We don't know at this point. I think we will all really have to wait for the Attorney General's office to come out with their report on it. And then I suppose we'll learn a lot more. But, everybody that I've spoken to who knew Dan McAlpin said he was a very pleasant young man. He had somewhat of an obsession with some cars that he had. He had cars that he'd like to work on. What this was about, we do not know. We have to wait for an autopsy report and, as I said, the Attorney General's office to complete their investigation. Yeah, it's these things are crazy. And we do not know what was going on in the minds of the state troopers. Were they protecting people who were in the room? Why were those people in the room? You know, all these questions that come up with one of these incidents. And the point has to be made that often these things move very quickly in directions that nobody understands at the time, or expects. And possibly that's what it was about. But at the moment, it really does not look very good. Not at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. Very tragic story. But let's move on to some lighter news. Let's talk about development and progress. What can you tell us about the advancement of New York Forward in Ellenville?
Well, actually, it's not. I got it wrong. It's not New York Forward. New York Forward is its new granting, $100 million that Governor Hochul has found in her $220.5 billion budget to spread around in smaller communities. This gets over the bias that the DRI, Downtown Revitalization Initiative granting, which those are $10 million grants. The NYF grants are $4.5 million. Anyway, the DRI grants have tended to end up at places like Kingston, bigger towns, bigger cities, and smaller places in rural areas have been left out. So in comes the NYF. Then comes this brilliant idea from the mayor of New Paltz, Tim Rogers, who calls up village manager in Ellenville and says, why don't we go in together in a barbell grant application, the two villages together, New Paltz and Ellenville, on a DRI. That's the Downtown Revitalization $10 million jackpot. So they're working on that very hard. Both villages have areas that could use the money. Ellenville obviously would use it to really revitalize the Liberty Square Market Street, Center Street areas that could use some work on facades. There's a lot of different things. And New Paltz has an area, I think, just to the edge of the village where they would like to put some investment. Now, one aspect of this that's important is that these grants, loans, what the grantors are looking for is private investment as well. And fortunately, Ellenville is in the position right now, having gone from zilch in terms of this kind of thing to having a bountiful, I mean, an overload, with various private projects on Market Street, such as the 23 Market Street project to convert the old Devil Dog Dungaree building into worker spaces and apartments and so on and so on and so on. And also a lot of work around Liberty Square, so that there's a lot of private investment to send next to any DRI money that came in. And should Ellenville score that sort of DRI money, and one obvious place that could be spent would be to put an HVAC upgrade and unit into and sprinklers into the Hunt Memorial Building, which sort of stands in the middle of the village, is a rather splendid looking structure, and could be a really remarkable kind of community center. But it needs HVAC because we're reaching the end of the season, the very short season, where it's usable and comfortable. So that's basically, in a kind of a nutshell, what that's all about. And also, the part of the barbell that's interesting that we should not forget is that the middle part is provided by Open Space Institute, which is working on upgrading the Smiley Carriage Trail, which leads up from Burmrog Park in Ellenville up towards and up into Minnewaska State Park. And then on the other side of the mountain, down on the Mohonk Preserve end, they're also working on trails there. So the idea with them involved is that they're also putting in their private investment, is that both ends of the barbell could connect quite easily, eventually, just on bicycles. You could just get on your bike in New Paltz and ride over to Ellenville and stay the night and whatever, see a show, then ride back the next day. And it's a sort of an opening to a kind of tourism that Ulster County really ought to have. I mean, if you go to other places in the world, the Rhineland, the Alps, parts of Italy, you know, this sort of tourist attraction and amenity. And it would be great for Ulster County to have this as well.
You're listening to the Reporters Roundtable on Radio Chatskill. I'm your host, Patricia Robayo. We'll be right back with Liam Mayo from the River Reporter and Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat. This is Radio Chatskill.
There's always a story behind the music, how the song was written, why the song was written. I'm Kathy Geary. Join me for Now and Then. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. It's fall, and that means it's time to get back in the kitchen, both for us at home and in restaurants. We'll get into what to cook this season and what's going on in the restaurant world. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Let's get back to our conversation with the area's journalists from the River Reporter, the Times Union, Shawangunk Journal, and also the Sullivan County Democrat. Here's Patricio Robayo from Radio Catskill, and the Reporters Roundtable continues.
Welcome back to the Reporters Roundtable on Radio Chatskill. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Leah Mayo from The River Reporter. Let's turn to you to see what's going on in Sullivan County. Broadband, high-speed broadband internet has been a big topic in recent years. It's always been an issue here in Sullivan County, and it has only been heightened more by the pandemic because of folks moving up here, going virtual, working from home. Sullivan County created a committee to help broaden the high-speed internet throughout the county. Liam, what can you tell us about the latest on the county's initiative?
For those who may not be familiar with Sullivan County's broadband initiative, the broadband LDC was formed from the county to pursue getting broadband access to as much of the county as possible. And for the past 2 years about, they've been pursuing broadband through this project to broadcast internet access through the county's public safety cell towers. And that project is sort of continuing, but recently they announced, or it's sort of been announced, that there's this public-private partnership that's going to happen with a new fiber optic or just fiber internet company, Archtop Fiber. And so this will be sort of going on in parallel to the LDC's current project. The idea is the towers can broadcast internet very well to some parts of the county. And then this fiber project could come in and cover the parts of the county where the broadband doesn't reach as well. Archtop, the company that they're partnering with, is a newly formed internet and phone company that's setting up shop in the Hudson Valley. It's looking to bring in up around $350 million in investment and trying to reach around 500,000 homes. So it's a pretty substantial investment that could reach up to 10 gigabytes per second upload and download speeds. This isn't something Archtop has announced. This is, they've announced kind of what technology they'll be using. And I just looked to see what kind of speeds that technology can reach. And that was sort of a general figure for it. So that could be a lot faster than people's potential current. And then this is something that's going to be built out, hopefully, over the next few years. So it's not something that'll immediately come in, but it's a really bright spot for the future.
Has this new company announced how exactly they're going to put these fiber cables in place in Sullivan County? Will it be run along the telephone poles that exist now? Will it be underground? How did they talk about the sort of the some of the details of the proposed infrastructure that has to go in place for this to become a reality?
I'm not 100% sure. I believe Archtop does plan to the home cable connections. I don't know what infrastructure they'll be using for that, but I do believe they will be putting additional infrastructure in place.
It will be definitely interesting to see that take place and see all that growth for high-speed internet. Recently, Sullivan County tried to pass a resolution reaffirming their support for the Second Amendment and also have language in the resolution that's attempted to turn back and repeal the current new New York State gun laws on concealed carry. Exactly where can someone carry a concealed weapon in the buildings that Sullivan County own? But there's an update to that bill.
The most recent update for that resolution is that it's a largely symbolic resolution. It's a resolution that's been watered down, so to speak, a few times since its initial draft. The initial draft had a resolved that Sullivan's declared a gun-friendly county, seemed to imply that anyone could carry a handgun anywhere throughout the county. Later on, it was revealed that that only applies to people in county buildings. And it also had a resolved that the Sullivan County legislature opposes the state's recent change to concealed carry laws and sort of urges the state legislature to overturn that. That draft got changed at the September 1 meeting of the Sullivan County legislature. It sort of took out that second part that would refer it back to the state legislature. And it clarified that this resolution is only going to apply to county buildings. So Sullivan County will let people carry weapons in county-owned buildings. That was the situation as of September 1. But the next day, Sullivan County legislator Roth Daugherty came out with a statement saying that it was symbolic of the legislature's feelings, but they can't really do that as of yet. They can't really allow people to carry weapons in county buildings based on their interpretation of the state's law. So that was sort of the main thing this resolution was going to do. And then either because they took another look at the state law or this was always the plan, they realized they couldn't do it. So they're still, Sullivan County is still looking into like what it can do regarding letting people concealed carry in county buildings. But as of the most recent update, as far as I know, the county doesn't have the authority to do that. So this ended up being a very symbolic resolution of the county's feelings on the Second Amendment and gun ownership, but there's not a lot the county can actually do. A lot of it is out of the county's hands and up into the state's hands.
I am curious on how come this resolution wasn't vetted more before it was brought to the public. It's just, you know, watching the public comments when this was on the floor, things got very contentious. So it just seems like it was unnecessary, and maybe it should have been more vetted before it came out to the public.
And it did end up being a very symbolic resolution, but I think a lot of the opposition to it was even just about that symbol, saying that, hey, Sullivan County is a gun-friendly county, sends entirely the wrong message to militia groups who might want to turn up and start doing drills or something. I think there was a lot of fear around the message that declaring Sullivan County a gun-friendly county could send. Even though the resolution doesn't change much, that message sort of still has gotten out there.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, it's the message was put out there. So let's keep it in Sullivan County. Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat. You were today we're recording this on a Wednesday, and you were at a press conference today about Move on Sullivan. What can you tell us about that?
We had a lot of different topics today, but I'm going to stick with everyone's favorite, transportation. And so Move Sullivan is a bus service that the county created about 3 years ago, contracting with Rolling V, which is one of the larger bus providers in the region, to have this service. And they had two routes for its first 3 years. And recently the legislature approved expanding it to four routes. So without going through the entire route of each routes, they're pretty much just route C and D, because A and B have already been in existence. Route C kind of takes you into Conneaugh Lake, into Bethel, White Lake a little bit, before going back out towards Monticello. And then Route D takes you out to Mamikating, into Wurtsboro and Bloomingburg. I think there's one stop in Rock Hill. So, and then back out to the Monticello kind of shopping area out by ShopRite, Walmart, and all that. So that's the expansion. There were two press conferences today, one to commemorate the launch of it, even though services started on September 1st. And that was, one was at the Bethel Senior Center. The other was at the Wurtsboro G-Mart grocery store on Route 209 in Mamikating. There were some similar speakers at both, and there were some specific speakers, like the chairman, Rob Daugherty, who's District 1 of the legislature, spoke at Bethel. Nick Salamone spoke at Wurtsboro, who's the legislator representing that district area. So, but at the press conference in Bethel, which I attended this morning, County Manager Josh Potosik talked about one of the roles of counties, which is to provide services to its residents. And this is one of the biggest services they can provide, and they've been doing it. Also, the legislature recently voted to remove bus fares. It was a low amount. I don't remember the exact amount, but they decided until at least the end of 2023 that it would be free to all riders, you know, considering that it has been being used. And also, too, trying to keep in mind with the economic climate right now, the rise of inflation. So to try to help out county residents. But now it provides service to 18 new stops in eight communities, which is in addition to the existing two dozen stops across 10 locations. And recently at a county legislature meeting, Laura Quigley, who's the commissioner of the Division of Community Resources for the county, discussed that, you know, she hopes to have further expansion eventually, maybe out to more outlying areas of the county, including Jeffersonville and such, which currently don't have any bus transportation options. But this is a big deal in the sense that, you know, gas prices are crazy and such. And you also have a lot of people, you know, that have immigrated to the area and stuff that might not have cars and stuff. So this is a useful tool for the community. So.
Definitely is. Access to the lack of access to medical, lack of access to shopping centers is one of the things that drives the health rankings, and we're second to last in those. So this is definitely will be a benefit to the county. So I'm glad to see that it's continuing on in this format. So but let's move on to some more development that's happening here. The Sullivan County International Airport just recently got some money from the state. What can you tell us about that?
I guess to touch on history, years ago when it was created, the thought was that this airport would bring common tourists to the hotels. And then, of course, we all know what happened with the hotels here. And that kind of left it, I would say, this is my opinion, not fact, without sort of an identity for a little while, even though it was in existence. But recently, there's been a resurgence with the airport in recent years. Just to give an example of that, fuel sales, the county decided a few years back to become the fuel dealer instead of just as far as part of the process when people came with their airplanes and stuff. And it was already rising. So for example, last year for 2021, the county sold $400,000 in fuel sales. But through August, with 4 months remaining in the year, they're already at $546,377. So fuel sales are up. Also, airport activity is up. So in the past, they would see about 400 aircraft in a year, coming through on average, but in July alone, they fueled 79 aircraft. So there's definitely a belief that that's going to increase as far as when the year's over. A lot of renovations have been put into the airport thanks to grant monies. A lot of different grant projects. They replaced runway lights, taxi lights, replaced 10 hangar doors, rehabilitated the main runway, have a new fuel farm, rehabilitated the taxiway. They're currently finishing up rehab on a 5-bay hangar, plan to construct a new 10-bay hangar in the future. And they were just approved for a $654,000, $144 grant to redo the airport's terminal transient aircraft apron. So as the superintendent for the airport, James Arnott, told us recently, they've essentially rebuilt the airport in 5 years. And speaking of grants, the county's the finalist for $15 million grant, which is in this pool of money, which is $235 million that the DOT is giving to eligible airports, which will be shared amongst ones that are chosen. And they would like to use that money, the county, if they receive it, to redo their terminal. So as far as the growth, you were mentioning the new tenant. So Hot Solar Air, which is a nonprofit, air agency that does like rescue missions and a whole bunch of life-saving measures through air travel. And recently they've moved into and rehabbed a hangar within the airport and recently held a grand opening for that. They've been operational in Sullivan County since midsummer. They still want to make the airport their world headquarters and have an application instilled to the FAA. They're trying to work out, which has like a grander, more extensive, elaborate plan there, but that's still in the works. But so for now, they're moved in there. And also there's a developer out of Quebec, which has been looking into the feasibility of a project at the airport, which would like update water and sewer and a bunch of different other things. So that's sort of some areas with the airport. And pretty much what the superintendent was telling me is that the business aviation market is growing. So at about 15% per year, as far as the rate goes. And that's left the question, where are these aircraft going to go? Because a lot of other aircrafts in the region are either filled up, there's not really any space left. And other places out of that are considered metroplex airports, where you can get to the city within a couple hours. Well, not a couple hours, sorry. I think you can get a 30-minute helicopter taxi, pretty much if you go to anywhere in this sort of region. So like there's one in Teterboro, I think it's called, down in Jersey. and such. And these are all sort of airports in the region. And they have more congested airspaces than Sullivan County does, because there's just not a lot of tenants compared to those places yet. But there is, so there's space available. They're on 600 plus acres of land. So that's definitely an area where they continue to see future growth. And as the, and the 6,300 foot jet runway, is, you know, a big deal for the county that they recently redid. And, yeah, so pretty much they've kind of found this identity I was talking about. You know, they were supposed to be this place to bring tourists to the hotels. Now it's turned in sort of to a state of the art executive jet airport. And that's where it's sort of found its success for executive jets. And it seems like it's not going to slow down anytime soon. So I'm sure me, Liam, and other folks will be reporting on that as it continues.
Air travel, private air travel, is definitely has gone up, according to an article I read in the New York Times recently. The nearest big airport that we have to us is Stewart International Airport, that has flights to had flights to Europe. I'm not sure if they're still going on, but definitely have flights to Florida. Is that is the Sullivan County Airport going to sort of compete with that and sort of, you know, take flights maybe from Florida soon?
Yeah, I don't see us being like Stewart anyway, shit, because that's more like commercial flights. I think that the county's still focused on these private jets. There is some talk and things in the works I've heard that would potentially see the county be more vocal with, or having more opportunities with, international flights, but like private flights. And we'd be looking probably more with Canada for that, because you know, flights from Canada and stuff, because you'd have to think, if with private jets, people are probably gonna have to stop a few times to fuel up if they're going to be traveling, unless they have a really good executive jet, which they might. But I would say we're more competing with the Orange County airports, the you know, other metroplex like Teterboro outside of, in Jersey and stuff outside the greater New York City region, than we would be with Stewart's. Who knows, maybe that could be a thing in like 50 to 100 years, but I think in the near future, it's going to main executive private jet style aircraft.
Definitely keep us up to date on those latest progress that happens at the Sullivan County International Airport. You've been listening to the Reporters Roundtable. I've been your host, Patricio Robayo. Today, I was joined with Liam Mayo from the River Reporter, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, Chris Riley from the Shawanakunk Journal, and Philip Pontuso from the Times Union. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us on the Reporters Roundtable, and we'll see you next month.
We'll take a short break and back with more of Radio Chatskill.
I mentioned the Folk Against Fascism double CD on the Waggle Load of Monkeys a few weeks back and said we should hear some of its excellent music, so that's exactly what we're going to do. So please join me, Graham Rice, for Folk Against Fascism on the Waggle Load of Monkeys here on Radio Catskill on Sunday afternoon at 3.
After a 70-year reign, Queen Elizabeth II will be laid to rest at Windsor Castle.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing.
Join me, Rachel Martin, live from London, for special coverage of the funeral at Westminster Abbey, September 19th, from NPR News.
Special coverage starts at 5 on Monday morning, here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Cancer Survivors Day is a dual location event set for today at McDade Park in Scranton and Saturday, September 24th at Kirby Park in Wilkes-Barre. The events feature the Circle of Survivors, an activity during which every person in attendance can say a few words about their experience with cancer. I spoke with the executive director of the 30th Annual Cancer Survivors Day, Michelle Frigoletto. She's better known as Mick of Mick's Barbershop in Honesdale. Mick is also a 5-year breast cancer survivor. She told us about the importance of the importance behind Cancer Survivors Day, not only for the community, but for her as well.
People get together who connect for support. They, you know, have conversations with each other. There's light refreshments. And it just provides people who have been had a cancer diagnosis or are caregivers just to kind of have outreach for each other and be supportive.
And you have a personal experience with this, and part of Cancer Survivors Day is to let folks say a few words about their experience with cancer.
Correct.
And yeah, would you want to say a few words about your experience and how you came to?
Yeah, oh gosh. Yeah, it was tough. Yeah, it was a real tough time, you know, and it was really great when people reached out.
It means a lot to you, I can tell.
Yeah, sorry about that. But yeah, no, but it's raw sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just great when people talk. You know, a lot of people don't want to talk about it because it was painful or they think it's going to go away, you know, but it's tough and you live with it, you know, even after. It's great to be on the other side of it because I'll be 5 years. This December, and life is good, and if you can help somebody who's having a tough time, you know, it really means a lot.
I can tell 5 years later, like you said, it's still there, and it's good to have that support. And it must be meaningful to you as well, being named the chair for the Northeast Regional Cancer Institute's 30th annual Cancer Survivors Day.
Yes.
Given all that you've gone through, what does it mean to you?
I'm so grateful that I can be a service to others. I have donated to the Northeast Regional Cancer Institute since 2011. All my buzz off money, I had buzz offs at the barbershop. We donated it to the Northeast Regional Cancer Institute, and they are a nonprofit. And they work their work to ease the burden of cancer in Northeastern Pennsylvania. So anything they can do for people to help them get through it. To the other side, it's wonderful to have an organization that can do that.
Your Buzz Off for Cancer has raised over $30,000, by the way. People should know that by cutting off beards and mustaches and more hair has really proved so meaningful.
My commitment to them is goes deep, and it's just another way that we can help each other.
And it's a dual location event. One is today in Scranton at McDade Park.
McDade Park. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is a week later on the 24th at Kirby Park in Roxbury.
Okay. And more information is available.
CancerNEPA.org.
Again, CancerNEPA.org. Next month is breast cancer awareness. It's not really just regulated to a month, right? It's definitely something people should be aware of. Cancer overall all times, right?
Yes, yes. But October, it just gets people aware that, you know, we need to check ourselves. We need to take an inventory and, you know, because it could save your life.
And anything else you want us to know about the Cancer Survivors Day and the Circle of Survivors?
Just it gives people an opportunity to tell their story or to be there for each other or caregivers. I can't tell you how. You know, my husband was with me through everything, and it was hard.
Well, I'm glad you're on the other side, as you said, and glad you're able to bring this Cancer Survivors Day 30th annual to the area. We've been talking to Michelle Mick Frigoletto from Mick's Barbershop on Main Street in Honesdale, and also the chair of the Northeast Regional Cancer Institute's 30th annual Cancer Survivors Day. Mick, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Tim. I really appreciate you getting the word out.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, listening to the bees. This is Radio Chatskill.
Did you know you can donate real estate to benefit Radio Catskill? Our program takes any property type, land, homes, commercial, in any location as long as there's equity. Even if you owe back taxes, have a mortgage balance, or deferred maintenance, it's no problem. If you have a real estate asset that is costing you money or not being utilized, donating is a great way to give back, and you may even claim a significant tax deduction. Go to WJFFradio.org to learn more.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The 8th Annual Narrowsburg Honeybee Fest is next Saturday, September 24th. It's a festival promoting awareness, demonstration, and education about our declining honeybee population. This year, an installation called Colony will be installed at the 108 on Main Street in Narrowsburg.
Colony by John Roach is an immersive sound installation that weaves together recordings of bees with interviews that explore our coexistence with these insects, as well as our compulsion to understand them through a human lens. The installation is paired with a work from a Parsons class called Honeybee Colonies, Art, Design, Science, and Culture. And joining us now is John Roach. He's the Associate Dean, First Year School of Art and Design History and Theory, and Associate Professor of Fine Arts at Parsons School of Design. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being here and telling us more about Colony and about the class. First, Colony, the sound installation. Can you describe to folks who might come what they will experience and how they will experience this sound installation of bees and interviews?
Sure. So, imagine you're going into a gallery space and you see a bunch of beehives, right? Not with bees in them, but a series of beehives and then a ring of speakers that are sitting on top of these beehives. And as you enter, you know, you begin to hear some sounds. And when you move into the middle of that space where these speakers are, you hear a mixture of different kinds of sounds, beekeepers at work, little snatches of music here and there, the voices of a number of people that I interviewed. And the piece is about 19 minutes. People can come in, they can sit and listen to the whole work, they can move in and out. There's a lot of different ways that you can experience it in the space itself. And then around the space there, as you'd mentioned, there's an exhibition of student work from a class. The reason I'm actually in Narrowsburg at this festival at all is because of Mark Randall, who I'm sure I'll talk a lot about in this interview. But Mark Randall is also he's a colleague of mine at Parsons, and he teaches an amazing class about honeybees where his students produce work related to honeybees.
Also a founder of the Honeybee Fest and Beeline Honey. So you spoke to a lot of different people about these insects, including a blind beekeeper, also an architect designing a bee sanctuary. And I mentioned in the introduction that you're exploring our compulsion with understanding them through a human lens. Why do you think that is? What is it about the bees that we feel we want to understand?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that really drew me to this, I mean, there were a number of reasons I started working with bees. One was really simply because of an invitation by Mark Randall to come and record his bees. And at that, you know, at that point, if someone says, you know, would you like to record my bees? I'm going to say yes. And then that kind of got me into thinking a lot about the role of bees in culture, and also this kind of compulsion, I think, to not only to understand them through a human lens, but actually also to kind of subjugate them through a human lens. So often, you know, if you think about a bee as a metaphor for something, traditionally we see them on banks. There's a lot of sort of religious significance of bees. So oftentimes the sort of metaphor of the bee is captured by things like industry or religion, the idea of chastity. And so I was interested in sort of thinking outside of that and what are some sort of, you know, some more community-based ways of thinking about bees as a metaphor. And so many of the folks that I talked to really kind of approached it from that lens, as this idea of bees as kind of folded into education, folded into, you know, the way that we can become a more, you know, connected society. And which they're a really good metaphor for this idea of communication, effective communication.
And you're bringing that into the Parsons class, Honeybee Colonies, Art, Design, Science, and Culture is the installation that's paired with your work. How did that come about?
Well, actually, that's Mark's. That is Mark's class.
That's Mark's and class. So, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the other reasons that I've been working with bees too is at a certain point he invited me to come visit the class and talk about bees and sound in particular. And so he has always this kind of rotating group of folks who come through and talk about bees from these really interesting disciplinary perspectives. And so, you know, the great thing about this class is that Parsons is part of the New School, and there is all kinds of, all kinds of different majors that students are studying in, everything from fashion design to literature to architecture to philosophy, et cetera. And he'll often get a really interdisciplinary group of students in this class of his, and they really look at bees through the angle of bee anatomy, the idea of the cultural significance of bees, the behavior of bees, and then how bees sort of exist with us as humans. And then students, based on where they're from in their own discipline or their interests, design projects that have bees kind of as a central, you know, a central factor in those projects. So I'm pretty sure what Mark is going to be showing is the result of many of these student projects, which are really phenomenal. I've visited the critiques for his end of the semester for those classes, and I'm always amazed at the work that students come up with and really great ideas that seem like they should be put out into the world.
Your work focuses on sound as part of your art, is that right?
Correct.
And
yes.
So how did you, when you were presented this idea of bees, of course, you know the sound they make, but what attracted you and what did you discover among this project, especially as it relates back to your work?
Well, this is so interesting. It's like, you know, if you think about bees, without a whole lot of knowledge of bees, we all come up with the same sort of thought if we think about, well, what does a bee sound like? You hear either the individual bee on one hand, or a cloud of bees, you know, the sort of collective roar of bees. And I think digging into it deeper, really learning about the kind of ways that bees communicate, the ways that they're, you know, some of it is this airborne, like if we think of our voice, right? It's an airborne sound moving through space. Bees communicate that way too, but interestingly, they also communicate by vibrating the hive itself and the honeycomb. So they're actually like sending all of these signals to each other, signals to the queen, signaling if there's something wrong with the queen. And it's a much wider variety of sounds than you can imagine. They make these incredible kind of quacking sounds, a sound called piping that really sounds like, you know, like a flute almost. It's really remarkable, these kinds of communications. And then also, you can kind of really hear what the state of the hive is, right? When they're agitated, you know it. And when they're calm, you know it. that's what was really interesting talking to a blind beekeeper. You know, this was Ariel Gilbert was one of the people I interviewed, and she was blinded, and I don't know if it was in her 20s or 30s, but she was a beekeeper before that. And so she really had to relearn what it meant to work with bees once she was blind. And so much of that is about vibration. It's about touch. It's about listening. It's about smell. And so really coming to them and kind of respecting the kind of communication that they're having within the hive.
Yeah. And folks can experience that with Colony, your installation, which will be at the 8th Annual Narrowsburg Honey Bee Fest next Saturday, September 24th. More information about the Narrowsburg Honey Bee Fest on their Facebook page and at narrowsburgbeefest.com. We've been speaking with John Roach from Parsons School of Design, the man behind Colony. And John, thank you so much for joining us and telling us a little bit about it. Can't wait to hear it.
It was a pleasure. Hope to see you there.
Thank you. And before we go, a programming note. Next weekend, there will be a celebration commemorating the life of WJFF Radio Catskill co-founder Malcolm Brown from 1 to 5 in Jeffersonville. Tomorrow night at 7 on Sunday Stage, we're remembering Malcolm with an encore of our 2015 interview with him on the occasion of our 25th anniversary, in which he recalls how the station got started.
There was a key thing that we did, namely we put a notice in the newspaper, and we asked a question to the readers. I think it was in the Sullivan County Democrat, but it was in one of the local newspapers. I think the Democrat. And it was a display ad, and it said, would you like to set up our own public radio station? Come to a meeting if this interests you. And the meeting was at the Lake Jefferson Hotel. Now, the Lake Jefferson Hotel was right on the borders of Lake Jeff. Right. It no longer is there, as you, I'm sure, know, but it burned down, 15 years later, or maybe 20. In fact, it burned down in a dramatic way and melted the wires that connect us to our broadcast.
Yeah, it took out our connection to the tower, yeah.
It sure did. It sure did.
Because it must have been about 14 years ago, because I remember it, you know, yeah. When that happened. I was here then. So it's in that neighborhood, yeah.
Right.
But that's where you had your first meeting.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And it surprised us. It surprised us, the organizers, the two organizers. And I think it surprised the people who turned out. You know, you look around. I guess it's like in a church. You look around and you say, why are all these pews filled up? You know?
Hear the full conversation with Malcolm tomorrow at 7 on Sunday Stage right here on Radio Catskill. For more information about the public memorial next Saturday, email malcolmbrownevent@gmail.com. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. W233AH Monticello.